Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
The International Biotechnology Trust started in 1994, and I came on board as the lead investment manager in 2013, so I've been with the trust almost 5 years now. This trust gives you high growth. It's a high growth sector. It has a strong performance and a sustainable dividend yield, and we're going to talk about that. So before coming here, my compliance officer said I really have to inform you about this disclaimer. Stocks can go up and down, and you can both win and lose money. So now I said that, and she will be very happy. Just be careful, you know. Let's start with the performance of the trust for the last 5 years. This is the performance for over 12 months, over 3 years, and over 5 years for the share price, the net asset value, the part that is the quoted portfolio that I manage is 90% of the trust, compared to the Nasdaq Biotechnology Index, that is the comparator index that we compare our performance to. So this is an index constituted mostly by, or only by, US companies, and you might think that is strange, but it's not so strange since most of this industry is localized in the United States, and it also mirrors the way that we invest. We have a couple of indices here, S&P 500, FTSE, and a comparative trust here in London called the Biotech Growth Trust. And you can see the net asset value for the trust over 3 years has outperformed Nasdaq Biotech Index 9%. And the NAV is 12%, and over 5 years we've done 47% versus 150%. And the quoted part of the portfolio that is now going to be the dominating part in the future has outperformed even more handsomely, 10% over the last 10 years and 30% over the last 5 years. So I mentioned that the trust also pays a dividend. This is somewhat unusual for the growth sector like biotechnology, but since interest rates have come down and investors are asking for a dividend, a return. The board decided almost 2 years ago to start a dividend, and we now pay a dividend of 4% of net asset value. That is paid out in two segments, one in January and one in August. So this might go up and down. It's a 4% of net asset value. Last year it was increased by 17% since the net asset value increased by that amount. The trust has been trading at a discount over the history of the trust until 2 years ago. It was approximately 10-15%. But after deciding about the dividend payment, we have seen that the discount, this lower part here, has decreased. And the trust has come into premium and is now at a slight discount of a few single percent. There are two reasons. The dividend was announced, and we also had good three-year performance because this is when I had my three-year tenure at the trust. So we hope that this trend is going to continue, and of course we also hope that we're going to be able to issue new shares. Historically we've been buying back shares, so before the dividend was announced it was buybacks in order to defend the discount, and since then we have not have been no need to do that. So let's talk about the dividend and how we think about it, and I would like to remind you that this is not a prediction about the future returns or anything. This is just an example. The Nasdaq Biotech Index has over the last 20 years returned on average 12% year over year. And if a manager would add, let's say, another 3% being an active manager, then the return would be 15% per year. We pay 4% in net asset value in a dividend. The remaining capital gain would in this example be 11%. And it is kind of a sustainable dividend payment for the future. You would get both capital gain and dividend if the future is going to be like history. And on top of that, everything in the trust is really capital reserves since the fund started 24 years ago. So I mentioned that the sector has grown by approximately 12% per year, and this is the facts behind that. You can see here a Bloomberg chart with the Nasdaq Biotech Index over the last 20 years. It's 98. To 2018, it's at 12.9%. You can see the graph below. And then the second one is the Morgan Stanley World Healthcare Index. So these are all the healthcare stocks in the world. And the lowest one is Morgan Stanley World Equity Index, so basically all the stocks in the world that are publicly traded. And you can do two conclusions here. One, that the healthcare sector has done better than the stock market in general, and that the biotech sector has been the high growth aspect of both of these entities. So this is history, and I mentioned that maybe this will continue into the future. And let me give you some leading indicators. First of all, the demographic shift that Elsa talked about in the video. In 2008, we had about 7% that were above 65 years old in the world. And in 2040, we expect this to double to 14%. And since you're healthy when you're young, and when you get older, you get more diseases, high blood pressure, or like this example, dementia prevalence over various age groups. So with an increasing elderly population, you will be more demand for healthcare products and drugs. So that is the demand side of the equation. Now, what is there on the output side? How can the industry meet this demand? And if we look at the therapeutic drugs that have been approved by FDA as a proxy, you can see since 1990, there have been an average of about 20 to 30 drugs approved each year. And last year it was 46. So it's really the highest approval rate in the last 20 years. This will transform into sales in the next 5 years of new drugs with high margins and high profits. If you look beyond the next 5 years and try to see, you know, how would this sector grow from 2025, 2030, we have to look in the development portfolio of the industry. What do these companies develop? And one way to look at it is to see, you know, how many drugs that are in development in various phases of drug development. So phase one is the first phase when you test if it's toxic or not in human beings. The second phase, you test what dose to use, you know, once a day, twice a day. And the third phase is when you test if it really works, you know, the big trial to make the statistics. And as you can see on this chart, each year since 2002 to 2016, there is more and more coming in the pipeline of the whole industry. So why is this? Well, the reason is that we are in an era of enormous knowledge increase, be it astronomy, be it, you know, mobile phones or biology, but it's less tangible to us, you know, to know what's going on in the laboratories. But we are slowly, with an increasing speed, understanding what lays behind the various diseases, and we are able to treat them. Also, the regulatory authorities have become more professional in handling approvals, and the Food and Drug Administration now has various designation, breakthrough, first-in-class, orphan drug, fast-track, and so on, in order to speed up the approvals. And the new commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, has declared that, you know, innovation is a good thing. More innovative drugs to the market, okay, they might be high priced, but if you can get more drugs to the market, they will compete with each other, and prices will actually come down. So projection for the top line in pharmaceuticals for the next 5 years, this is Evaluate Pharma in the May 2017 report, is that in the worldwide, the prescription drugs are going to grow by a healthy 6%+ CAGR. That's a compounded annual growth rate. It looks pretty good, I think. So this industry has big companies that develop sell drugs all over the world. But also there is an innovation side where smaller companies are better at developing drugs. Most of these drugs come as innovations out of universities, new science, new things. And so the large caps, the large companies that have global distribution machineries, they typically acquire small and mid-cap companies. And this is a constant theme. This is the volume of announced life science industry-wide M&A events per year. And you can see here that approximately 300 events per year, and in the last couple of years, it increased a little bit. And the premiums paid, you know, for public companies, if you look at, this is the premium here, how many percent uptick the stock had in the day that the deal was announced. On average, you can see that over the last 10 years, the premiums have been, you know, about 50% or so. So if you hold a company that's going to be acquired, usually you get a great reward. This is from the 1st of January 2016 until now. We have had 7 M&As last year, and this year we already had Celgene acquiring Juno that we held, and then Novartis acquiring AveXis, that is a gene therapy company. It's not that we focus on this area particular. This is not an M&A trust, but since a third of the trust is in the sweet spot of M&A, where a drug has just recently been approved or just recently had good phase III data, we're definitely going to harvest some of these M&As. Let's talk about the risks also for this sector. The risk could be price pressure in the system. There could also be patent risk. I think there also could be a risk that there's no more innovation. Three risks that are pretty important to this sector. Let me start with the last one, that innovation would diminish. I think there is actually an upside risk to this now. Innovation could actually increase even more. That's the opposite risk. There is no lack of innovation. Hopefully, in 100 years, we solved all the equations and everyone is treated and everyone is healthy. Right now, there is a big medical need and the industry is really producing a lot of new things. The patent life, I don't think, is anything of a problem. It's really the pillar of Western society, capitalism. You invent something and you get 10 or 20 years patent life in order to create a monopoly so you can earn back your investments. I don't think that will change at all. The problem really we've been discussing in the last two or three years is price pressure in the U.S. where they have very high costly drugs. The system is a free market system where you can have any price you like for drugs, and the drugs are much higher priced in the U.S. Donald Trump has complained about this. Now, the U.S. system is different to ours. It's a multi-payer system, so it means that it's not paid everything by the taxes. In the U.K. and Europe, it's a single-payer system. Everything is paid by the taxes and everyone is insured. But in the U.S., it's not. Our view is that there is really not a risk to any legislation change in the U.S. so that we will come into a single-payer system. Remember, in the U.S., we have a Republican Party. They command the high Supreme Court, almost the whole Hill, and the president is a Republican. And that's usually a very industry-friendly environment. I think it will stay industry-friendly, meaning also friendly for business in healthcare and in pharmaceuticals. But there will be price pressure in certain areas where there are drugs that are very similar in the free market. They will compete with each other. Another way to look at this is for the federal spending, that is the money spent by the government of the United States. So that would be Medicare, Medicaid, and some other parts. It's about 30% to 40% of the healthcare market in the U.S. Now, if you look at how much is spent on drugs, so drugs are 11% of the total cost, and 89% is everything else. It's hospitals, physicians, nursing homes, and so on. So if you're going to fix the U.S. system, it's not by reducing the drug price. And overall, it's really not a big driver of the growth of the cost either. If you go to Express Scripts and you look at their annual report for last year, drug cost per capita in their system increased by 1.7%. Let's look at the valuation of the sector. This is PE numbers for various large-cap biotech companies in the U.S. And you can see on average for 2019, you have 14, 12, depending on if you do median or mean, and S&P 500 is at 13. So it's not the FANG sector, it's not P70. And the reason that they've come down so much is, okay, the growth has slowed down, but also there's been headlines in the news about how sustainable is this pricing environment in the U.S., and I believe it is sustainable. So second slide on valuation, this is large-cap biotech companies in the U.S. in the last 13 years. And you can see that both the PEG and the PE premiums now are at almost a historical low. Let's talk a little bit about the trust now and switch subjects. So after going through the sector, the investment process that we run in the trust is a kind of a traditional model. We look at the companies and the stocks in our sector. We follow medical and investment conferences. We can use cash and gearing, so we can gear up to 30%. The board has said we may only use 15% as a facility, and currently we are geared at 1% or 2%. We kind of think the market is pretty high, and there might be a setback in the market, and if that happens, we will gear up when the market is down. We do DCF valuations on certain M&A targets. We also follow the news flow very carefully in order to do our risk mitigation strategy, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So we keep an active management around binary event. So this sector, as you know, is a very risky sector. You can lose all your money in a small cap company that is a one-trick pony that has a drug that fails. 90% of the value can go away and you'll remain with cash. So in order to, even large companies can actually go down pretty much on a bad event. Let's say something doesn't work. So what we do is try not to invest over the binary event. It doesn't mean that we don't invest in stocks that have a binary event, but at the time of the binary event, we try to sell out of these stocks and well in ahead of that, maybe 2 or 3 months ahead of the binary event, in order to avoid losing money. Sometimes the binary event might be an uptick for the stock. Okay, we don't cry if we missed an uptick, but we're very happy if we don't lose any money. And this is not the homebrew investment strategy. If you do look at the financial research, there have been many reports about how to invest over binary events. And this is actually a strategy that wins over having a portfolio of investments in binary events and thinking that you're smart enough to know which ones are going to work or not. I mean, that's the whole point of running a clinical trial, isn't it? To find out. And if everyone believes it's going to work, it's going to be in the price anyway. The stock is going to be pretty high. If nobody believes it's going to work, the stock is going to be low. So we try to do this as much as possible. You get the knife in your back sometimes. So you're hit, sometimes you're hit by something that you can't predict. But to a large extent, this works pretty well. So the portfolio currently looks like this. We have a net asset value at the end of February of £227 million. We have a geography where we have 90% in the U.S., 10% in Europe. It's not that we particularly like the U.S., but that's where most of the investment opportunities are. We don't do any FX hedging, so you would be exposed to the dollar. And if you like to hedge, you can do it yourself. Regarding the various caps here, we have our third large cap, third mid cap, and the third small cap. And also this corresponds to profitable with sales and only early stage. So we try to kind of keep a portfolio that is across the various sectors. This has changed somewhat in the last year. We used to do 50% large caps, but we have reduced that because we see the large cap growth has come down and they have some problems. And instead, we have increased the small to mid caps where we think there's more of a growth opportunities. Now, this is not UK small and mid caps. Small caps are still, up to $1 billion. So, I mean, it's another kind of a range. And then, more importantly, therapeutic areas. We do 40% oncology right now and about 20% or so rare diseases because this is an area where you see less price pressure. So, especially in the U.S., when life is at stake, or life expectancy, or children's health is at stake, then it's more difficult for the system, be it a single-payer system or an insurance company, to say no. And in the U.S., in most states, it's actually a law that somebody with cancer that you have to treat with a drug that the doctor prescribed. You cannot go with another drug that's cheaper for the system. So it's kind of a little bit of an insulated area. And if I would see for the future, maybe oncology will even increase somewhat. The second reason for oncology being large is that there are many investment opportunities. There are lots of advancements in this particular area. And I exemplify this on this chart where you can see the treatment options for oncology in 1996, 2006, and 2016 for various diseases. Let's take lung cancer as an example. In 1996, there were four chemotherapy drugs approved. 2016, there were seven, and there was a new category called EGFR inhibitors. And today we have five categories and quite a few drugs in each of these categories, be it tyrosine kinase inhibitors, immunotherapy where you have your own immune system fight the tumor. And in this case, we had very good data the beginning of this week from Merck in the U.S., where Keytruda, a PD-1 inhibitor, is an antibody, together with chemotherapy actually prolong life pretty much for in all stages of these types of first-line lung cancer. So definitely it's getting very crowded in a way for innovation. It's getting difficult for even for an investment manager like me to keep track of all these things, you know, what is going to win, what's going to lose, and which one is better than the other. You know, I have to sweat much more now than I did 10 years ago, I'll tell you. The top 10 holdings in the portfolio, we run a pretty kind of traditional model where we don't like elephants, so we, you know, 5% is a big holding, I think, 5-6. And then we have a long tail, so we have 67 holdings, but it, you know, there are many companies are small or mid-sized, and we keep half a 1%, 1.5%, 2%. But in this top 10, we also see some companies that don't have that big market cap. This is, you know, we call it small cap, $2.6 billion. As compared to Biogen and Celgene, they're big. Neurocrine, Genmab, Sage, and Exelixis is kind of a small to mid-cap company picks that will generate alpha for the trust. I also mentioned that there is a part of the portfolio that is unquoted investment. It's a legacy portfolio of individual unquoted investments. And then we have a run-in portfolio of an investment in a fund. We shift the strategy from investing in individual companies because it's most tedious and difficult to rather invest in a venture trust. It's SV Fund 6. We're part of the SV organization, so it's kind of within our turf. And it's going to be, so unquoted, it's going to be approximately between 5 and 15, the board states, but I guess it's going to be approximately 10. And over the next 3 years, we're going to see Fund 6 come in and be a larger part, and this blue and brown kind of being reduced down to zero. And then we can make a choice 4 years from now if we would like to make a new investment in another vehicle or not, depending on the outcome of this investment. But so far, the Fund 6 is actually up, so it's doing pretty well. Awards, and to sum up here, we have a trust that is exposed to both growth and yield. The sector has strong fundamentals. We have a unique approach to risk mitigation. And we are supported by SV Health Investors that I'm part of. And this is the slide of the team.
Thank you very much. Can we open that up to questions, please?
Thanks very much. Very interesting presentation. I observe that geographically you're solely in the US and Europe. What about geographies like Japan?
Japan has very few innovative small biotech or mid-sized companies. Most of the companies are conglomerates to start with. Kirin Kinova has a brewery and a pharma. Mitsubishi has, you know, other industries and car industry and whatever. So there are a few companies like Ono, Santen, Takeda, Stellas, but they're pretty large. And they run a very local, most of them a local business in Asia. So we've decided, okay, we're not going to do Japan.
Could you tell me what percent cash do you typically keep out of the total NAV, and what percentage turnover or churn do you do each year?
So we typically have a cash position that is between max 10% cash under a serious condition that I haven't experienced. It needs to be a serious financial crisis, I think, and a leverage of 15%. And the leverage, since I started 2013, I thought that it's better to play this safe. Of course, you should leverage max. You know, you have interest rate 3% or 2%, and then, you know, this growth is 12 or 15% per year. But there is also volatility in the market, and if you leverage up and the market is down, you're going to underperform. So I decided in 2013 to do a tactical leverage. So when the VIX, the volatility index, is about 20, we leverage up. And when the volatility index is down, we pay back our debt. I think you generate more performance, not kind of on the leverage side, but more on the picking the right stocks anyway. So, but I think we have made some extra money doing that type of leverage. The second question was about the turnover. It's been about 150% per year. Maybe even 200% at some point. M&A contributes to turnover. So we have had quite a lot of M&A transactions. We sell them on the announcement. If the deal is announced today, we sell it today or tomorrow. We don't keep it for the. And then also this active strategy of risk mitigation means that we actually sell out of certain stocks in order to avoid this binary situation that also creates a turnover.
Carl Hald, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.